In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Canadians are also being pushed into a corner with more lockdowns based on the RT-PCR testing, known to have a 90% inaccuracy of false indications. We've heard Dr. Fauci say that using the PCR test at a cycle of 35 will not yield accurate results. Yet the FDA has instructed to set the magnification cycle on the PCR test to 40. If you want to get even more false positives, then yes, set the PCR test to 40 cycles of magnification. The Fourth Estate, corporate-owned media, has proven itself to be a public relations firm for the international cartel and their so-called reset. If and when things calm down, remember the innate bias and continuous broadcast of false, unadjusted pandemic statistics imposed by major networks. Politicians are supposed to provide leadership and protect freedoms, but now many are likely following mandates from the United Nations and the Davos Group. Did you hear the Canadian Prime Minister's statement about using the pandemic, which has a 99% survival rate, as, quote, an opportunity for a reset to, quote, accelerate our pre-pandemic efforts to reimagine economic systems that actually address global challenges such as extreme poverty, inequality, and climate change? On this show, we have investigated and covered many facets of climate engineering. There is irrefutable evidence produced by top researchers on this topic. If you want to find past shows on this topic, go to inothernewsradio.com. Inothernewsradio.com, one word. You can go into the search bar and type in climate engineering, and the shows will come up. As we covered on this show, the PCR test is not accurate. It's a tool now used to lock down populations. Here is part of an interview on the YouTube channel Trigonometry. So that's a word, trigger, like trigonometry, but it's trigonometry. And they have the guest, Professor Bakhti, a Thai-German specialist in microbiology and co-author of the book Corona, False Alarm, Facts and Figures. Let's have a listen.
I and my wife are not doing this for fun. We, in March, when the first lockdown was looming, sort of, we thought, this is weird. The situation, there's something wrong about the whole business, the whole story, because it's out of this world. It cannot be true.
Why not? Why do you say that? Every government in the world seemingly has accepted this idea that lockdowns are the way to deal with this. Why isn't it the right solution?
Exactly. That's what we couldn't understand. And that's why we started making these videos, trying to reach out to the public, to everyone in the social media. Since the mainstream media were certainly going the other way, dragging everyone like the Pied Piper, you know, people following the tone of the Pied Piper. But it wasn't the rats anymore. It was the population all around the world. And we couldn't believe it. So we stood up and said, people, now, why do you believe everything you're being told? Why don't you sit down and read and think a bit? Because if you did that, you would very quickly realize that there's something very, very fishy going on. You started, you know, with the definition of what is COVID-19. Originally, COVID-19 was defined as the severe illness caused by a virus named SARS-CoV-2, all right? It was so complicated that no normal person could understand what was going on. And that was the beginning of the end. Because then, you know, this PCR test came out and became the gold standard for diagnosing COVID-19. Now, anyone who studied, you know, infectious diseases knows that a PCR test cannot be used to diagnose anything. A PCR test is a lab test that may be used to support a diagnosis. So if you think someone is ill, has fever, is coughing, you know, is short of breath, then it's quite legitimate to do a PCR test to try to find the gene of that virus that you're looking for. And if you find it, or parts of the gene, because a PCR test only looks at parts of the virus genome, very small parts, then it's okay. Then you say, all right, this would confirm the clinical diagnosis. But a real doctor doesn't go around testing people with a test that has never been put on the market for use to diagnose a disease. It's only there to see whether you have parts of this virus genome, you know, sitting around in your throat or your nose. And then the terrible thing was that whenever this PCR test was positive, that person or patient was labeled COVID-19 case. But COVID-19 is the term used for the disease. And that's where everything really started getting crazy, because this virus, that's the second thing, this virus was termed a new virus and COVID-19 was termed a new disease. But in fact, neither the virus is really new, nor is the disease really new, because the coronaviruses have been with us, with man, since the beginning of mankind. You know, these are viruses that coexist with us. Every few months, a virus will change a little bit because they mutate all the time. Mm-hmm. They have to mutate, otherwise they can't keep on, you know, going back and forth between you and me and animals or whatever you want. So it's a completely normal thing that these viruses, which are the most successful viruses in the world, together with the flu viruses, by the way, because they manage to keep the host alive. They don't kill the host. They don't want to kill us. They want to come and visit me, and then they want to go and visit the next guy, you know. In order to be able to do this, they change very little all the time, so that when they come back next year, they can come and visit me again. Otherwise, my immune system, you know, would not allow their entry at all. You see, this is something that people don't really understand. So when we started reading up to see what's going on, we realized that no one knew about this. So we tried to tell people, you know, a positive PCR does not mean that you are infected. It could mean that, you were infected, and now they're just pieces of the genome lying in your throat, and you take a swab and take it out, and then this PCR machine multiplies that genome. So the number of cycles will tell you how many times this genome has been multiplied. It's like, you know, sort of an alcohol breath test. You drink one mil of vodka, you're not drunk, but if you drink 100, you are drunk. So you get caught in the police control and you do this breath test, and you've only drunk 1 milliliter. So the police say, okay, keep on going. We see that you did drink a bit, but you drank so little that you didn't reach the red mark.
Mm. Mm. Finally, you've put it into language Francis can understand, Dr. Yeah. Bhakti. Thank you for that.
Yeah, so the PCR machine actually tells you, you know, the number of cycles, the cycle threshold that it went through until the test was deemed positive. But the cycle threshold has never been standardized, you know. So, in fact, when the PCR machine says you're positive, it might have just measured 1 mil of the vodka, you know, 0.05, but you're still tested positive. Now, while the police say, okay, keep on driving, your politicians now say you go into quarantine.
But Dr. Bhakti, I want to ask you a question. So you say there's something fishy going on. Could you expand? What do you mean by that?
It means that the way of, first of all, diagnosing this disease, COVID-19, is at variance with everything that anyone learns in infectious diseases. You're using a lab test to make a very serious diagnosis, all right? As I said, this PCR test will light up if you have 0.05 per mil in your blood of alcohol. This is the same thing. And yet you're deemed to be COVID-19 case. That means that you have a serious disease and you enter the records as a COVID-19 case.
So to put it in very simple language for people listening, what you're really saying is the PCR test is likely to massively exaggerate the number of people who are actually suffering symptoms of COVID-19.
Oh, yes, horribly. I mean, so much that it's criminal to say that these are COVID-19 cases. Because everyone in the world believes, oh, my God, you know, now we've had 250,000 COVID-19 cases in Germany. But in fact, you probably have had, I wouldn't be able even to estimate, I can tell you that probably, and we've had 10,000 COVID-19 deaths. But of these 10,000 COVID-19 deaths, 90% were deaths due to other causes, like heart attack or stroke or whatever. It's just that they happen to test positive for this damn virus.
Mm.
With a PCR test that lights up the moment bits and pieces of this virus or another virus that is related to this virus has gotten into your throat, you know?
So, Dr. Bhakti, if this is the case, right, and of course, I trust what you're saying, then why is it we're going into lockdown? Because you can't be the only person to think this. I'm sure there's great swathes in the medical profession that do.
Well, to our great relief, the world's foremost epidemiologist, Professor John Ioannidis of Stanford, actually published a paper that was back 3 weeks ago.
Mm.
And this paper is peer-reviewed. It means that it's been seen by 3 to 4 experts, leading experts in the field. And the WHO put this paper on its bulletin, which means the WHO accepts that this is the correct data, all right? And you go and read that paper, because John Ioannidis said what we said months ago, that this virus is no more deadly than a seasonal flu. And for people under 70, it is even less deadly than the seasonal flu. If you are under 70, your chances of dying with or because of this virus are less than 0.1%, all right? In fact, they are about 0.05%. This means that 5 out of 10,000 infected people may die because of the virus. 5 out of 10,000. This is so little that there's no reason to do anything. Not only the lockdown is nonsense, everything else is nonsense, everything. And this is published. Everyone who's watching now should stop and think for a moment. Anyone can look at this paper. Anyone can look at the bulletin of WHO and should. And then they should come back and say, listen, since it is now internationally accepted that this virus is not the killer virus that one thought it was, and now, since the pandemic has actually come to an end, the epidemic does not exist in Europe, it does not exist in America, the number of cases and fatalities have almost gone down to zero, anyone who says that anything is being done for any scientific reason is lying.
That was Professor Bhakti, Thai German specialist in microbiology, author of Corona False Alarm, Facts and Figures, being interviewed on the channel Trigonometry. The majority of independent thinking people would reject this worldwide reset. This isn't about COVID-19. The pandemic is a catalyst for economic hobbling right now. This is another phase of the United Nations Agenda 21 and their world sustainable development goals. Whether you like it or not, it's coming, but you will be persuaded. If Canadians, for example, aren't persuaded by more lockdowns, there are ways to manipulate them. There's a story that reads, the Canadian military wants to establish a new organization that will use propaganda and other techniques to try to influence the attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors of Canadians. The plan comes on the heels of the Canadian forces spending more than $1 million to train public affairs officers on behavior modification techniques of the same sort used by the parent firm of Cambridge Analytica. The new Defense Strategic Communication Group will advance national interests by using defense activities to influence the attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors of audiences, according to the documents dated October 2020. Target audiences for such an initiative would be the Canadian public, as well as foreign populations in countries where military forces are sent. Can you imagine a mass migration away from the major networks, a complete rejection? What would that look like? We've been talking about the opt-out factor for a while and had a profound call-in show about it several years ago. Did you happen to catch the censorship hearing with the heads of Facebook and Twitter? Have a listen to this.
Now, on October 15th, Facebook relied on a third-party fact-checker's assessment to ban two advertisements from Facebook for, quote, partly false information. Now, both of these advertisements were factual in nature, and they revealed Joe Biden's and Kamala Harris's views on late-term abortion. Joe Biden has stated that he won't accept any restrictions on abortion, and Senator Harris's views are such that she voted against requiring care for a child born alive during a botched abortion. The very next day, the third-party fact-checker issued a statement retracting the assessment and retracting it as erroneous. However, it stunningly took Facebook almost two more weeks until October 29th, when voting had already started in many jurisdictions, to lift the ban on these legitimate ads, ads that the fact-checker had already declared a couple weeks earlier were erroneously taken down. So, Mr. Zuckerberg, why on earth did it take Facebook 2 weeks to correct this error?
Senator, I'm not familiar with the details of us re-enabling that ad, so I can follow up with you after. It's possible that this was just a mistake or delay, and unfortunately, when we handle millions or billions of pieces of content a day, while we strive to do as well as possible and be as precise as possible, we will make some mistakes.
Thank you. I appreciate your acknowledgement of the fact that there are mistakes. As I've noted previously, those mistakes sure happen a whole lot more on one side of the political spectrum than the other. Now, this is understandable. We're humans, but it's also understandable why this might occur. Maybe some of it has to do with your employees. 92.83% of Facebook employees who donated to federal candidates gave to Democrats. At Twitter, it's even more stark than that, as if it could get much more stark, but 99.3% of Twitter employees who donated to federal candidates gave to Democrats. And so these mistakes They may be mistakes, but they're mistakes that rhyme. They may not repeat themselves, but they rhyme. And the consistent theme happens to be Republicans, conservatives, and pro-life activists. Now, I'd like to ask both of you, is there a list of every user or every content creator who has been deplatformed or had their contents reach altered or have had some other adverse action taken by either Facebook or Twitter altered? Is there some list that identifies each user for which that has happened? Mr. Zuckerberg, let's hear from you. Just a yes or no question. Does such a list exist?
Senator, I'm not aware of anything like that existing.
Mr. Dorsey, how about you?
Well, certainly whenever we take an action, it's recorded somewhere yep. in a database, but I'm not sure if that's your intent.
No, that's helpful. So what I'm hearing from both of you is that while there may not be an actual list, and I'd like you both to check to see if such a list exists, but even if there isn't, there is a de facto list because you have within your databases records of occasions when this has occurred. And so I'd like to ask both of you, if such a list exists, please send it to me. I'd like to see it. If such a list does not exist, you certainly do have the data necessary in order to generate some. And I request, as a member of this committee, that you generate such a list and provide it to me. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Senator Graham, the chairman of the committee, has stepped out momentarily. I've been directed to recess the hearing momentarily so that we can go and vote, and then we will pick up back here in just a few minutes. I would like to, as long as I have the gavel momentarily, mm-hmm. I'm going to ask one more question before I leave to go vote, and then we'll recess the hearing. Mr. Zuckerberg, in September, Facebook tagged an ad run by the American Principles Project in Michigan that criticized Joe Biden and criticized Senator Gary Peters. The ad was tagged because it was, quote unquote, missing context. Now, the next day, the ad was shut down entirely by Facebook. Facebook relied on a supposed fact check from PolitiFact, which is a nice way for you to avoid taking accountability for the problem, except that the fact check in question literally said that the ad, quote, makes, quote, predictions we can't fact check. Apparently, this had to do with lacking context. So when did lacking context become a new standard for political ads? I mean, all political ads, all ads in general, but certainly all political ads lack context. Ben Sasse just finished a resounding victory in Nebraska, and I haven't seen his TV ads, but I'm sure they're brilliant. This guy's made for television. He's with or without the beard. And I'm sure his ads didn't say, Ben Sasse, great senator, but not that great of a hockey player. Or there's always context that is lacked out, that is lacking, left out in any advertisement. So what does that mean? And have you applied the missing context label to any Democratic ads, a single one that you can identify?
Senator, I'm not familiar with that specific standard, but as kind of a background on the fact-checking program, the basis of this is that we have heard resoundingly from our community that people do not want to see misinformation and believe that it is a problem. But people also believe that they do not want Facebook to be the arbiter of truth in deciding everything that is true and false. And for what it's worth, I strongly agree with that. And I do not think it is the right thing for us to assume that role. So within those bounds, we've tried to create a fact-checking program that works with independent third parties who have been accredited by the Poynter Institute for Journalism, which I think is widely respected. And we give those fact-checkers the latitude to determine whether ads or other content on our service is accurate, and if not, we apply some demotions or we prevent them from being run as ads. I can follow up in more detail afterwards on
Thank you.
On the specifics of your questions, since I'm not as familiar with them right now.
I would appreciate that very much if you'd be willing to do that, because it's not only inconsistent with logic and with what the standards that apply in every other advertising context that I'm familiar with. It's also inconsistent with what Facebook itself does. Just to give you some context for that, while we're talking about missing context, I recently posted something about the election on Facebook. My Facebook post was almost immediately tagged with the following, quote, election officials say that voter fraud, which is historically rare, has not affected the outcome in this election. They have confirmed that mail-in voting was conducted in accordance with state voting rules, close quote. Now, I find this a little disturbing. Tagged to me sounds a whole lot more like state-run media announcing the party line rather than a neutral company, as it purports to be, running an open online forum. This kind of editorializing insulates people from the truth, and it insinuates that anyone concerned about voter fraud must be crazy. It also states it as if it were an irrefutable, neutral, objective fact. Now, maybe these kinds of concerns are out of the mainstream in Palo Alto, but they're not out of the mainstream with the rest of America. I hope this kind of manipulation wasn't intentional, but it's getting harder and harder for me to accept the premise that it could be anything but intentional.
The Associated Press, Fox News, CNN, and MSNBC can't call the election before it's certified. Remember, Al Gore didn't concede until mid-December. And regardless of your candidate, the world is watching a subversive attack against the United States as supporters of fair elections investigate and expose voter manipulation. One silver lining is that worldwide focus on a corrupt voting system could unite people, prompting efforts of reform, fixing avenues of vulnerability. As each day passes, more evidence comes in, clearing the fog of how votes were stolen. Meanwhile, the true enemy of the people tells you that there is no evidence of voter manipulation. The glitches and anomalies revealing voter fraud and manipulation are reported to have occurred in swing states because of the large number of votes for President Trump. Let's go now to hear part of a press conference from lawyers who are legally challenging the voter fraud and voter manipulation that occurred during the presidential election of 2020.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for coming. This is representative of our legal team. We're representing President Trump, and we're representing the Trump campaign. When I finish, Sidney Powell and then Jenna Ellis will follow me, and we will present in brief the evidence that we've collected over the last, I guess it is 2 weeks. Also, Joseph Geneva, Victoria Tenzing are here with me. There are a lot more lawyers working on this, but we're the senior lawyers, and Boris Epstein. So I guess the best way to describe this is when we began our representation of the president, we certainly were confronted with a very anomalous set of results. The president way ahead on election night, 700,000 or 800,000 in Pennsylvania. Somehow he lost Pennsylvania. We have statisticians willing to testify that that's almost statistically impossible to have happened in the period of time that it happened. But of course, that's just speculation. As we started investigating, both our investigations and the very patriotic and brave American citizens that have come forward are extraordinary number of people, extraordinary number of witnesses. And what emerged very quickly is it's not a singular voter fraud in one state. This pattern repeats itself in a number of states, almost exactly the same pattern, which to any experienced investigator, prosecutor, would suggest that there was a plan from a centralized place to execute these various acts of voter fraud, specifically focused on big cities. and specifically focused on, as you would imagine, big cities controlled by Democrats, and particularly focused on big cities that have a long history of corruption. The number of voter fraud cases in Philadelphia could fill a library. Just a few weeks ago, there was a conviction for voter fraud, and one 2 weeks before that. And I've often said, I guess sarcastically, but it's true, the only surprise I would have found in this is if Philadelphia hadn't cheated in this election, because for the last 60 years, they've cheated in just about every single election. You could say the same thing about Detroit. Each one of these cities are cities that are controlled by Democrats, which means they can get away with anything they want to do. It means they have a certain degree of control over, certainly control the election board completely, and they control law enforcement. And unfortunately, they have some friendly judges that will issue ridiculously irrational opinions just to come out in their favor. So let's start with the specifics. Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, the margin of victory now for Biden, which is not a victory, it's a fraud, is 69,140 votes. The reality is that we are now at a count of 682,770 ballots, for which we have affidavits that there was no inspection of that ballot at the time that it was entered in the vote. It was a mail ballot. Mail ballots are particularly prone to fraud. We were warned about that by Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter, and Secretary Baker in a report about a dozen years ago, in which they said that mail balloting is particularly susceptible of fraud, that we should very carefully consider ever doing it, and that it can be taken advantage of. Justice Souter warned us of the same thing in a comment in a election law case. And even the New York Times wrote articles about how dangerous mail-in voting was. And this is the first time we ever did it en masse. And I think we proved that all three are prophets. It's not only susceptible to fraud, it is easily susceptible to fraud, particularly if you have a plan or scheme which sounds eerily similar to what Joe Biden told us a few days before the election, that he had the best voter fraud team in the world. Well, they were good. I don't know that they were that good, because they made significant mistakes, like all crooks do, and we caught them. One of them was pushing out Republican inspectors. Every state, almost every civilized country, even Tanzania and places you wouldn't think of, have rules about inspectors, particularly for mail-in ballots. And why particularly for mail-in ballots? Because they can more easily be defrauded and you can't check on it. People who have never done a mail-in ballot, I'm going to show you why it's so easy. Well, you fill out an envelope like this. You put your, usually in New York, it would be your assembly district and the precinct in which you're voting. You fill out your name and your address, and you sign it. You then use an inner envelope, and you put the ballot inside the inner envelope. You seal it all, and you send it in. When it's being counted, almost invariably in the United States, up until the mass cheating that went on in this election, a Republican and a Democrat inspector, as well as others, if there are other parties, is allowed to watch the unsealing of this ballot. Used to go on all over America when we conducted honest elections. Because the only time you can ever find out if it's a fraudulent ballot is when it is looked at. The minute you approve this, it's thrown away, gone for eternity. The only thing left is the vote. That could have been Mickey Mouse. That could have been a dead person. That could have been not filled out properly. That could have been the same person 30 times. That could have been, and all these things have happened, by the way. That could have been nothing filled out. We'd never know. So, for example, the recount being done in Georgia will tell us nothing, because these fraudulent ballots will just be counted again because they wouldn't supply the signatures to match the ballots. So it means nothing to have counted these ballots because, for example, in Pennsylvania, where we have probably our most precise evidence, 682,770 of these ballots were cast, put in, and they weren't inspected, which renders them ballots that are null and void, cannot be counted, have to be removed from the vote. Why? For several reasons, not the least of which is that was basically only one of two places in the state where it was done. So in the other parts of the state, there was a legitimate inspection of the ballots. So if you have two different standards in different parts of the state, one favoring one part of the state, the other disfavoring the other part of the state, that's a classic violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. Bush v. Gore being the most recent case that that teaches that. That's not the only fraud that went on in Pennsylvania. All of the other frauds carried out in the other states by the Democrat bosses happened there as well. For example, if you made a mistake in that ballot and you lived in Philadelphia or in Pittsburgh, you were allowed to fix the mistake. But if you lived in the what would be considered more Republican or Trump parts of the state, you were given no such right. One of our plaintiffs, Mr. Henry, cast a absentee ballot, and he failed to put it in the secure envelope inside. He just put it in open, naked. That ballot was cast aside because it was invalid, because that breaks the privacy of the vote. In Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia, if they noticed that there wasn't an inner envelope, they'd contact the voter and allow him to vote again. Or if he didn't fill it out completely, or if he made a mistake and didn't sign his full name, he was allowed to cure it. There is no such provision under the law of Pennsylvania. The Democrat Secretary of State made that up in order to maximize the votes in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and to minimize the votes in the other parts of the state. Clearly illegal, clearly voter fraud, easily provable, hundreds of witnesses, maybe thousands. We have, to give you another example, we have 17,000 provisional ballots cast in Pittsburgh. Do you know what a provisional ballot is? Provisional ballot usually happens this way, and about 15 of the 17,000 happen this way. You walk in and you say, I'm here to vote today. Oh, Mr. Giuliani, you already voted. I did. I don't remember voting. Oh, yes, yes, you cast an absentee ballot. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. So why does that happen 17,000 times in Pittsburgh? People walked in thinking they actually 15,000 to be precise. Why did it happen 15,000 times that people in Pittsburgh walked in to vote and they had already voted according to the Democrat election machine? Did they forget? That many people with bad memories in Pittsburgh? Or is the following correct? That as witnesses will testify, they were instructed by the Democrat bosses, when they had a ballot in which there was no one registered, just assign it to somebody. Just assign it to Rudy Giuliani. So when Rudy Giuliani, and maybe Rudy Giuliani won't show up to vote. And if he does show up to vote, we'll give him a provisional ballot. That is what we call circumstantial evidence of the fraud. The direct evidence of the fraud of the people who will testify that, in fact, that's what happened to them. As well as the 50 to 60 witnesses we have for the way they were treated and not allowed to inspect the ballots. They weren't just not allowed to do it. They were pushed, few cases, they were assaulted. In all cases, they were put in a corral so far away, probably the closest they got is from here to the back of that room. We could do like a, did you all watch My Cousin Vinny? You know the movie? It's one of my favorite war movies because he comes from Brooklyn. And when the nice lady who said she saw, and then he says to her, how many fingers do I got up? And she says, three. Well, she was too far away to see it was only two. These people were further away than my cousin Vinny was from the witness. They couldn't see a thing. Now, I don't know. You're going to tell me that 60 people are lying? They didn't just tell me this. They swore under penalty of perjury, which is something no Democrat's ever done. You don't even ask Biden about this. You don't put him under penalty of perjury. He doesn't even get asked questions about it. He doesn't get asked questions about all the evidence of the crimes that he committed. These people are under penalty of perjury. Their names are on an affidavit. They swear that they weren't allowed to carry out their function as inspectors. And it's not just a technical thing. There's a reason they did it. Why would you not allow people to carry out the function they've been allowed to do for 50 years, 60 years? Why wouldn't you allow inspections of those ballots? Because you knew you were going to use those ballots to catch Biden up. And you had a big road ahead of you. You had to catch him up for 700,000 to 800,000 votes that he was behind. And the only way you were going to do it were with the mail-in ballots. You couldn't have a Democrat and Republican inspector around. They don't even have Democrats watching because they'd be afraid that there'd be honest Democrats who would say, you're cheating. So that takes us to Michigan, where there was an honest Democrat who said they were cheating. And we'll show you her affidavit, because I know you keep reporting falsely that we have no evidence, that we have no specific acts of fraud. That's because the coverage of this has been almost as dishonest as the scheme itself. The American people are entitled to know this. You don't have a right to keep it from them. You don't have a right to lie about it. And you are. I mean, you don't report to them that a citizen of this country, a very fine woman, who was willing to allow me to give you her name. I can't give you all these affidavits, because if I do, these people will be harassed. They'll be threatened. They may lose their job. They will lose their friends. We've lost lawyers in this case because they've been threatened. We've had lawyers that need protection. What's going on in this country is horrible, and the censorship that you're imposing is making it worse. But Jesse Jacob is an adult citizen and a resident of the state of Michigan. She's been an employee of the city of Detroit for decades. She was assigned to voting duties in September, and she was trained by the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan. She was basically trained to cheat. She said that I was instructed by my supervisor to adjust the mailing date of these absentee ballot packages to be dated earlier than when they were actually sent in. The supervisor made that announcement for all workers to engage in that fraudulent practice. That's not me saying that. That's just American citizens saying that under oath. I don't know. Maybe you could say she's lying. But you can't say there's no evidence. This is what we call evidence. This is direct evidence. Not circumstantial. I tried many, many cases, as did all my colleagues here. You put a witness on a witness stand, witness is testifying to their own knowledge. This witness goes on the witness stand and she will say, I was told to adjust the date on the absentee ballots. I witnessed election workers and employees going over to the voting booths with voters in order to watch them vote and coach them for whom to vote. Completely illegal. She will testify to that. I don't know. Biden's people can cross-examine her, but you can't just throw it away. Gee, there's no evidence. Next time you say that, you'll be lying. because there is evidence. This, oh, by the way, this is public. You can all get it. It's attached to the complaint in Costantino versus the city of Detroit. Then she was instructed by my supervisor not to ask for a driver's license or any photo ID when a person was trying to vote. Don't ask for identification. Why would you not ask for identification? Because you knew that a lot of people not entitled to vote were going to come in and early vote. Because you knew that illegal immigrants were going to be allowed to vote. You knew, if you lived in Philadelphia, unless you do not, that's an Italian expression for stupid. Unless you're stupid, you knew that a lot of people were coming over from Camden to vote. They do every year. Happens all the time in Philly. It's about as frequent as getting beaten up at a Philadelphia Eagle basketball football game. Happens all the time. All the time. And it's allowed to happen because it is a Democrat, corrupt city. And has been for years. Many, many years. And they carried it out in places they could get away with it. They didn't carry it out in neutral places. They didn't carry it out in Republican places. They didn't carry it out where the law is respected. They carry it out in a corrupt city where the district attorney releases criminals en masse, which is why it has so much crime. She also said, I observed a large number of people who came to the satellite location to vote in person, but they had already applied for and submitted an absentee ballot. So she observed a lot of people voting twice. Again, this is Jesse Jacob, not me. I was instructed not to invalidate any ballots and not to look for any deficiency in the ballots. Why would you do that? Because you're cheating. On purpose cheating. Intentionally cheating. You're cheating as a institution. This is an instruction from the election commissioner or the employer to the worker. Don't look for any deficiencies in the ballots. I was instructed not to look at any of the signatures on the absentee ballots. If she was instructed to look, not to look for any of the signatures on the absentee ballots, why the heck do you sign it in the first place? In order to identify it. She was instructed not to do that because many of the absentee ballots were fraudulent, and they knew that, and they didn't want to have a count of that. On November 4, 2020, I was instructed to improperly predate the absentee ballots when the receipt date was actually after November 3rd, 2020. Now, this is really significant because Justice Alito of the Supreme Court instructed Pennsylvania that any ballot that comes in after 8 o'clock on November 3rd, 2020 had to be put aside and not opened because there's a question as to its legality and its constitutionality. What she's telling you is that they blatantly disregarded that order, that they took ballots that were marked the 4th and the 5th and the 6th, and they marked it down for the 3rd in blatant disregard of the order of the United States Supreme Court. I don't know if she's a Democrat or Republican. I assume if she's working for the city of Detroit, that she's a Democrat. I assume, but I may be wrong. She's a citizen. I've never met her, never coached her. And I'd like you to note that it's signed under penalties of perjury. We have 100 more of these. I can't show them to you because those people don't want to be harassed. They don't want to have their lives torn apart by the goons on the other side. We don't do that to them. They've done that to a lot of our people. They've done it for 4 years. And it's outrageous that it's tolerated. And it's tolerated because you condone it in the press. And you don't cover it. And you don't condemn it. And it shouldn't happen to a Republican or a Democrat. A lawyer shouldn't have to withdraw from a case because he's representing the president of the United States. There are many more affidavits here. I'd like to read them all to you, but I don't have the time. You should have had the time and energy to go look for them. That's your job. Like it's my job to defend the president and to represent the president. It's your job to read these things and not falsely report that there's no evidence. You know how many affidavits we have in the Michigan case? 220 affidavits. They're not all public, but 8 of them are. 4 affiants here, those are people who give affidavits, report an incident that under any other circumstances would have been on the front page of all your newspapers if it didn't involve the hatred that you have, irrational, pathological hatred that you have for the president. What they swear to is that at 4:30 in the morning, a truck pulled up to the Detroit Center where they were counting ballots. The people thought it was food, so they all ran to the truck. It wasn't food. It was thousands and thousands of ballots. And the ballots were in garbage cans. They were in paper bags. They were in cardboard boxes. And they were taken into the center. They were put on a number of tables. At that time, they thought all the Republican inspectors had left. All but 2 had. And an employee of Dominion, who we will address a little bit later, Dominion. And here's what they jointly swear to, that every ballot that they could see, every thing they could hear, these were ballots for Biden. When they saw a ballot, these were ballots only for Biden, meaning there was no down ticket, just Biden. Many of them didn't have anything on the outer envelope because these ballots were produced very quickly, very swiftly, and they're estimated to be minimum of 60,000, maximum of 100,000.
According to Google Analytics, prior to the 2020 election, there was an increase in searches of terms such as the penalties and jail time for election fraud. The World Economic Forum warns of a new crisis, with economic and social implications more significant than COVID-19. They're referring to a large-scale cyber attack. There have been concerns of cyber attacks to utilities and dams in the U.S. coming from China. They might be from China. They might also be from within the United States, considering what we know and what we've seen in the past 5 years. Remember how Joe Biden was shouting during his presentations about a dark winter. Let's hear from the World Economic Forum leader and founder, Klaus Schwab, talk about this dark winter.
We all know, but still pay insufficient attention to the frightening scenario of a comprehensive cyber attack, which would bring to a complete halt to the power supply, transportation, hospital services, our society as a whole. The COVID-19 crisis would be seen in this respect as a small disturbance in comparison to a major cyber attack. To use the COVID-19 crisis as a timely opportunity to reflect on the lessons the cybersecurity community can draw and improve our preparedness for a potential cyber pandemic.
Sounds like if the pandemic doesn't have the intended effect, there are additional phases of warfare waiting to be deployed. What are your thoughts on the comments of Klaus Schwab? That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.